doing it. And last year, the Census Bureau statistics on the number of Americans that are uninsured for health care reasons grew by about 1.2 million people. And over a million of them were people with over the median income. So it's people who are working for jobs that have benefits where the employers are dropping them. How much do we spend on this? We're spending about $6,500 for every person, every man, woman, and child in the state on health care. It's a little more than that nationally. That figures out for a family of four like mine, that's about $26,000. Most people don't realize it's that much. They may not be able to afford the bills, but they don't realize that's how much is being spent. But if you count all payments, the government payments, Medicare, Medicaid, you count all employer payments, you count all employee premiums, you count all co-payments, deductibles, excluded care, it's about $6,500 per person, and we still have many people without health care access, as I mentioned earlier. Other countries, Germany, spends about half what we do, and yet they cover all the people. We might hope that we'd be getting better outcomes for our great expenditures. We're not. In life expectancy, one of the common measures of the quality of medical care, the average American dies more than 4 years earlier than the average Japanese person. We are 20th ranked in life expectancy. That's better than a lot of third world countries, obviously, but it's not where we should be given the fact we're spending almost twice as much as many other countries. We're 37th ranked in infant mortality. We have more than twice as many infant deaths as in some other countries. And we don't overuse our system. One of the complaints about the system and one of the reforms that people always talk about is how can we reduce the overconsumption of health care. Between 2000 and 2002, just for comparison, the U.S. had average number of visits to a doctor by average patient was 3.6 visits over that period of time. In Germany, it was double that at 7 visits. Japan was twice that even. It was 14 visits per person. So we are not using healthcare nearly as much as other countries, and yet we're spending far more. Impact of our higher costs, the impact of unaffordable insurance, the impact of co-payments, deductibles, excluded care, means that over a third the population says that they have put off needed care because of costs. That means includes skipping their medications or taking half a pill instead of a full pill or not seeing the doctor when they are needed. And I wanted to interrupt my testimony here to take testimony from Dr. Ann Setgas because she has to leave fairly soon for an appointment. So I'd like to interrupt this for just a couple minutes to have her testimony because she may have to leave soon.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator, please go ahead.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, how are you going to do this? You're going to take testimony, and then after all the testimony is done, then the senators would ask questions. Is that what you'd prefer? Or how?
Madam Chair, Senator Boring, I would be happy after, if this witness, if you have questions for her, you can ask questions. Then, but I'm only interrupting it for that because of the fact that she has to leave. But beyond that, after my testimony, you can ask questions. Otherwise, I'll then be going through the bill. You can ask questions then.
Okay.
Then with witnesses, you can ask them one at a time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Senator Marty. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. Yes, my name is Dr. Ann Setgas, and I actually have clinic this afternoon, so thank you for allowing me to speak now. I'm an internal medicine physician, and I work here in St. Paul in both the outpatient clinic setting and also in the hospital setting. Thank you very much for having me speak. It's an honor for me to be able to discuss with you an issue about which I am extremely passionate. I've been committed to single-payer healthcare since I began directly caring for patients during my residency training at the University of Minnesota. I love practicing medicine, especially internal medicine, and having spent a significant portion of my training and work thus far in the developing world, I feel very fortunate to be able to practice in a setting where high-quality health care does indeed exist. However, it is impossible for me on a daily basis to feel completely satisfied in my work because our system as it is now has tremendous inefficiency and inequity that I witness every day. I dream of a day when I can take care of patients and make my medical decisions solely based on medical knowledge and their best interests. Right now, because of the current chaos and complexity of our multi-payer system, I find that this is very difficult, and I will share an example with you. I recently took care of an 80-year-old gentleman in the clinic who came to me with an illness that was quickly diagnosed as pneumonia. He wasn't sick enough that I needed to put him in the hospital, but he needed antibiotics. The antibiotic choice and the treatment duration that I chose for him were standard of care for management of outpatient pneumonia. However, I quickly learned that his insurance company only would cover 4 days of the drug that he needed, when in fact standard of care would call for 7 to 10 days of this particular antibiotic. I spent the next 30 minutes of my day talking to his insurance company and explaining why this gentleman should receive the medically appropriate course of treatment for his pneumonia. And in the end, he did get the treatment he needed. But clearly, this is not an efficient use of my 30 minutes. I also have the privilege of taking care of hospitalized patients. And in this setting, some of the cases that I see are very unfortunate. And, oh, is it not loud enough? Sorry.
Yeah, they're just not very loud. Oh, sorry.
Okay. So I was saying that I also have the privilege of taking care of inpatients in the hospital. And some of the unfortunate cases in which I am involved there are a routine reminder of what happens when we are unable to provide effective preventive care or manage chronic illnesses in the outpatient setting. From a financial perspective, I think any of you would recognize the value of keeping a patient healthy and out of the hospital. The costs are extremely high once patients become ill enough to be hospitalized. Last month, I took care of a 60-year-old woman who was admitted to the hospital to undergo chemotherapy and radiation for her cervical cancer. And as you probably may know, one of the greatest successes of modern medicine is the Pap smear. With this very inexpensive and simple test, we've managed to cervical cancer is 100% preventable, and we rarely see it now. This patient that I took care of, like the majority of uninsured Americans, was fully employed and worked 40 hours a week, but for a job that was not able to provide her coverage. Therefore, she received no routine medical preventive care. And this is simply a tragedy. This case was a tragedy that I shouldn't see. It's one example of how, by providing preventive care, we can save tremendous amounts of money, but also decrease unnecessary suffering in our patients. But then, as you probably can imagine, even if doctors do the best job we can, patients still become ill, even if we do all the right things on the outpatient side. And I see this when I'm rounding in the hospital, situations where patients have become seriously ill and their illness becomes even more devastating because they are so concerned about how they will pay their bill because they're uninsured or they lack proper coverage. So I will round on patients in the morning, and their questions for me instead of questions about their medical care or how are they going to pay. And for me, this is just an unbearable situation. You know, one of the buzzwords that we hear a lot in healthcare reform proposals these days is personal responsibility. And as a primary care provider, I very much value preventive care, and I emphasize personal responsibility in making healthy lifestyle choices with my patients every single day. But I also know that for the majority of my patients who become very ill, their only risk factor for doing so is the fact that they're human. And this is why it is still unclear to me why we do not consider healthcare a basic human right and why we do not treat it as a public good that we all deserve. I know that fellow physicians face similar frustrations to mine every day, and I also know that many of them share my thoughts. I'm proud to say that in the state of Minnesota, this is definitely the case. There was an article published regarding a study done in February of 2007, so 1 year ago, that surveyed about 400 physicians randomly in the state of Minnesota, and they were given options on their preferences for how to finance health care. The choices they were given were single-payer health care, health savings accounts, or managed care, and an overwhelming 64% of respondents chose single-payer. And this is clearly to me because we know that in a single-payer system, we would dramatically slash the excessive administrative costs in our current system, and thus we would save the money that we could use and that's needed to expand coverage to all uninsured Minnesotans, but also we could provide better care to those of us who are already covered. So in closing, I would just say that from my perspective as someone whose sole interest is not in underwriting or in advertising or marketing or in turning an exorbitant profit, but only in taking care of patients and providing the highest quality of care. I firmly believe that single-payer health care is the only financially sustainable, affordable, and ethical option. So that's my testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Sedgast? Senator Corey.
Madam Chair and Doctor, the last thing that you said is you said that this plan will cut administrative costs and save a lot of money. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? And if so, then are we still going to have the oversight and that we need to have?
That's a good question.
Dr. Sagast.
Yep. So the administrative costs that would be slashed are, we know currently about 30 to 31 cents on every healthcare dollar is spent on administration. And in the private insurance industry, this goes to costs like marketing and advertising, underwriting, which is the process of figuring out which patients you can afford to cover, and also profits, and sometimes for the CEOs and administrators and for the company itself. And in a single-payer system where you don't have multiple payers, you would slash all of that. You wouldn't need underwriting, you wouldn't advertise or market, and you wouldn't turn excessive profits. You would simply make enough money to manage the system. And then your second part of your question was, would we have enough oversight? Mm-hmm. I would argue that we have much more oversight now than we need, as given by my example of a gentleman who clearly needs 10 days of antibiotics, but his insurance company is, for unclear reasons, telling me he can't have them. I mean, that's an oversight that I'm happy to get rid of. I don't know if there was something else.
No, Madam Chair, I do have another question.
Doctor,
are you familiar at all with the Canadian plan? How familiar are you with that? And, you know, I guess I need to travel up there, or I need to educate myself better, because a lot of people that I run across say, well, we need to have something similar to Canada. But I was on a plane a while ago, and somebody was from Canada, and they were down here accessing health care.
Yep.
So
mm-hmm.
if it's so great up there, why would that person come down here? So I guess I'm just kind of puzzled.
That's a question that we hear, or I hear a lot. And certainly Canada does have a single-payer healthcare system mm-hmm. similar to what is being proposed in the United States. There are several important differences in comparing, and the first is that we spend about double what Canada spends. So in our system, some of the problems that are seen there are simply due to underfunding of the system, and we wouldn't need to do that because we already have so much money in the system because of the waste that we're using in all these other areas that we would better fund it. There was a second part of your – was that the – I'm trying to think what the other part of your question was. There another part of the question?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. And I guess just from an administrative standpoint, too, the other piece that I didn't mention in terms of where the cost savings would come from is when there are multiple payers, you can imagine in an office like the primary care clinic that I work at, we require a significant workforce just to take care of our billing. I mean, we have people whose sole 40-hour weeks go to figuring out how to collect our payment from all of these different payers. And if we could streamline that system and bill one payer, it would significantly cut those costs as well.
Thank you. Any more questions? Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. I guess I wanted to just, in your testimony, you were talking about the administrative costs and that the desire would be to find savings, and I'm a little confused about that. My experience has been, and my reading of economic history has been, that when you have competitive forces at work, that's where you see efficiencies and cost reductions. You talked about how the system wouldn't have any profit in it, but profits are where investments come from and where innovation comes from. So if you design a system where there's no profit, where does innovation come from? And I guess if you look at all the things we do in the private markets, and over time, what we've seen is higher quality of services, typically at a lower unit cost. We have not seen that typically in healthcare, and that's already a very heavily dominated governmental influenced operation. And why we would say, let's have more of that and expect to get the benefits that typically accrue to market environments. Why would – I'm confused by that. Maybe you can give me some – your take on how that would work.
Yeah.
Senator Marty, you want to respond?
First on
please.
It? I want to make a couple of points about that, and one of which is, first of all, it is for-profit doctors, for-profit pharmaceutical companies. It's much of the research is being done now, much of the innovation is funded by government already, public institutions. A whole lot of what drug companies call research is marketing. But in terms of that, there still is a profit in the system. It's the providers that do. I don't think we're having great innovations in the health insurance plans in terms of how we can sell insurance at a better rate. I mean, we don't have, realistically, we don't have a competitive marketplace in terms of insurance buying, and because of that, we don't have much of a competitive marketplace in the rest of the healthcare system because I can't choose, I have limited choice of which doctor to use and so on, and some people have very limited choice. They have to lose their doctor when they switch jobs and health plans. You're not going to have as much restrictions on choice there in a plan like this, but the part where you'd be losing the profit motive is the health plans, where they're simply figuring out who can market most cleverly, and I don't see how that adds a penny, a thing to the good quality of health. You look at one of the big ones that can't directly serve as a health plan in Minnesota, United Healthcare. I really don't think paying executives $100 million a year is improving anybody's health care. They're not even health care providers. They're just an insurance company.
And
Dr. Segas, if you would like to respond, and then Senator Hamm has a follow-up response.
And, you know, regarding the market in general in healthcare, I'm not an economist, but from what I understand, companies that do the best are those that provide the best product, at the highest quality product at the highest quantity. And I guess I would argue from a perspective of a health insurance company, you have to actually produce or provide less product in order to make more profit, if that makes sense. In other words, you have to take care of patients who are less ill and so therefore provide them less health care in order to make more money. And to me as a doctor, this is the opposite of what I want. I want to provide more health care to the people who are sickest, not less health care. And so I think it's a backward. I think the market sort of doesn't work in private insurance because it's a backwards concept.
Senator Hand, do you have a follow-up question?
I understand. I don't want to get too far in here, but I just I'm not sure I'm accepting the argument that you're making. I guess the you as a doctor, mm-hmm. for money, you wouldn't do it for very long, at least, if you were losing money. And so everybody needs to make a profit in what they do. Let's acknowledge that. I think that, Senator Marty, some of the things you've mentioned about the lack of a competitive environment in Minnesota are certainly true, but those are things that we have put in place by law, primarily, and we have put in place by law things that have restricted and diminished the marketplace. And then to say that somehow now we don't have a marketplace and that's a problem would seem to me to say, well, then we've got to change those laws and encourage the development of the marketplace before we decide that it doesn't work. So, Madam Chair, I don't want to – I know there's a lot of other questions, a lot of more testimony, but I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to remind the members that we have a few other people who would like to testify. Senator Dahl, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might. Just a couple of quick questions. You mentioned earlier about the survey mm-hmm. of over 400 physicians, yep. and they were given those options, mm-hmm. and you said it was overwhelming. Do you have a little more specific number?
So 64% of the respondents were in favor of a single-payer system as opposed to the other options, which were health savings accounts or managed care.
And, Madam Chair, one follow-up on that. In terms of, say, making a profit or earning a living mm-hmm. off of your profession, mm-hmm. Is there a concern amongst doctors that going under a single-payer plan would cause them to make less money? Or do they feel that they could still earn the type of money that they are now under that type of plan?
Dr. Segas.
Yeah, and that's certainly... I mean, I certainly expect to make a good living. I work hard, and I want to be compensated for the hard work that I do. And there is not a concern about doctors not making enough money. I think that there are some echelons of medicine in which various subspecialists are making extremely high salaries. And I do think potentially that those could come down slightly. But I think for the average physician like myself, or even some of our specialists, there would be no reason why we would make less. We would still receive salaries. I would still be paid. And the system would be delivered privately. So, I mean, healthcare is publicly funded but privately delivered. So it's no different now than us billing Medicare. I mean, I'm still going to make my salary whether my patient's care is paid for by Medicare or by Blue Cross Blue Shield. I mean, I make the same amount of money. So, no, I'm not concerned about that.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson Rose and then Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple quick questions from your perspective as a physician. You know, we hear some of these questions about market-based industry and competitive forces, and where does innovation come from if we go to single payer? So as a physician, if drug advertisements and all that marketing is taken out of the picture in a single payer, how would that affect you as a physician?
I think the issue of direct-to-consumer advertising is a huge issue in and of itself that we could spend some time discussing, and I certainly do have some opinions on that. But I don't personally believe that marketing drugs specifically to my patients in any way improves the quality of their care.
Okay. Thank you. Another follow-up question then.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the market-based approach then was taken out of the picture, where does your commitment to patients come from and your innovation come from then if it's not market-based?
Well, my commitment to patients comes from the fact that I'm a physician and I'm a professional I'm professional, and I went into medicine because I wanted to take care of sick people. And so I don't see a conflict at all there. I mean, I do need to be paid for what I do, certainly, but I guess I just don't see a conflict there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Siegest, a couple different things. The survey that you mentioned, was this a scientifically developed survey with a scientific basis and a margin for error?
I have a couple copies of it here if anyone would like it. It was published in Minnesota Medicine, which is a monthly magazine read and published by physicians, and I can certainly give you a copy of it. When you say scientific, do you specifically mean?
Was it a science? I'm sorry, Madam
Chair. Senator Wergen.
Was it done by a reputable company based on a scientific sampling of physicians?
It was a random survey, so the drawbacks would be that the respondents were people who chose to respond, and they may have felt strongly one way or the other against single payer or for single payer. I don't know. I mean, so I can look up the numbers and tell you how many were sent versus how many returned and all of that. I don't have it on the top of my head.
Sure. Thank you.
The staff will collect
you, Madam
Chair. Give us a copy. Senator Wergen.
That it really wasn't scientifically based. If the circumstances you're talking about are the case, then it wasn't then it was basically a random sampling, not with scientific basis.
It was a random sampling.
Secondly,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Was there a question on the survey that indicated that in countries where these types of health plans are in place, the doctors' wages and benefits were significantly lower than they are in the U.S. Was that a part of the, was that revealed on the survey so the doctors knew?
No, that was not a part of the survey at all.
Thank
no.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, one last
Senator
question.
Senator Wergen.
In some of the countries where these types of health plans are in place, a lot of the cost savings or significant savings comes with beginning and end of life issues, and I see several folks in the room that have the same color hair that I do. And I know that, for instance, in some countries, age prohibits certain treatments. When one reaches a certain age, they no longer qualify for instance, open heart surgery or a transplant. And at beginning of life, there are certain measures that are not taking to save a premature baby. Mm-hmm. Would you advocate for those types of things to save money because that is where the savings are?
First of all, I would argue that that is not where the savings are, and I don't know of any data that supports that specific information right there. I know in looking at very high-tech medical procedures that are often done on very elderly people, things such as hemodialysis, bone marrow transplants, kidney transplants, the United States is not at the top of those countries in terms of providing those types of care. I know that many of the countries who have single-payer health care actually provide very high technological care at the end of life. So I don't believe that the savings seen in single-payer systems come at all from maybe what you would think of as rationing care. It sounds like you might be suggesting, and that is not a system that I would advocate, and nor is that what single-payer is about.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Prenasala.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr., I'm a psychologist. I sit on a oncology team. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you say that already though some of that discrimination is occurring, and I don't like the word discrimination, but some of that critical judgment is already used in making decisions for people regarding where they are at the end of life, on quality of life, and ability to survive procedures and many, many other types of things that go into making those decisions.
I mean, as an internist, I take care of very elderly patients, and we do make decisions based on the end of life every day because that is a reality for many of my patients. But those decisions are always taken on an individual basis. I would also argue, though, that for a large share of the population, these decisions are never even made because they don't access the healthcare system. And so, you know, we have many people who are not receiving appropriate or high-tech end-of-life care simply because they're uninsured or underinsured. So that's a much larger concern.
Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you, Dr. Segas. We really appreciate that you were here. Who do you have next, Senator Marty? Just want to say before you continue, Senator Marty, that we have a great audience outside of this room as well, that senators and everybody should know that there is a great deal of interest in this area, and we are very pleased that so many people have come today to hear the presentations. So we want to acknowledge that there are several other community members that are outside of this room paying attention to this issue. Go ahead, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm going to continue with my testimony now. The only reason for hers was because she has to leave. But in terms of when we decide how we reform healthcare, I think the first thing we ought to do is figure out where we're going before we figure out how we're going to get there. And at the beginning of the bill, if you look at page one of the bill, the requirements of the health plan, it lists nine principles that the plan would be required to meet. And I think that that's important because when we talk about these issues, like the one Senator Wergen just mentioned, end-of-life issues, I don't think government, or for that matter, health plans should do what people think of as rationing of health care. I think rationing of health care should be done by the individual. And if we were aggressive in getting out living wills, advanced directives, most people, I'll guess well into the 90 percentile, say if they're terminally ill and they're in pain, their heart stops beating, they don't want to be resuscitated. If you don't have an order like that, they will. And I think the way we reduce end-of-life care costs in that sense is let people make their own decisions about it. I strongly believe it's not the role of government or any other health plan to do that. And on these principles, you'll see the second one of them listed is that we should not restrict, delay, or deny care or reduce the quality of care to hold down costs. We use other means to hold down the quality of care. But these principles are very important. The first one obviously being that all Minnesotans receive high quality care regardless of their income. And as I mentioned, there's about 400,000 without any insurance whatsoever and perhaps a million plus more who are unable to pay the costs of all their co-pays, their excluded care, which is often dental care and things like that. The third principle here is that we cover all necessary care, and that includes mental health services. It includes chemical dependency, which is a major gap in our system. Now, we used to be the number one state in chemical dependency. Now our chemical dependency treatment slots, we are 47th among the states. There are only two states that do worse than us. So we want to include chemical dependency, prescription drugs, medical equipment and supplies. When people with diabetes can't afford their insulin, that's something that's sadly wrong with that process. Dental care, that was one of the biggest issues we heard in the past year. Long-term care, home care services, comprehensive health care. We should allow patients to choose their own providers, you can see, is the fourth point. Scroll down further on the list of them, you can see we have to make sure we have an adequate number of health professionals in every part of the state. It doesn't do you any good to have access if there are none available to serve you, and in many parts of the state, psychiatrists are very short. Waiting lines to see a psychiatrist, even in the metro area, can be very long. And the eighth one here I'd like to mention, too, continue Minnesota's leadership in medical education, training, research, and technology. And that's critically important because Minnesota is a leader, a national, international leader in terms of medical technology with firms like Medtronic. We're world-class in terms of medical education and medical research and medical facilities, Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota, other institutions. And we have some of the best doctors and nurses and people of every medical profession in Minnesota, and we have to make sure a system is designed in a way to control that. So we last year in this committee passed a bill that was asking for us to look at a plan that would meet all of these principles, and I think any health reform is not getting there until we get to these nine principles. So now to the health plan and what it involves.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cornyn.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think it's important that this is an extremely important bill, as we can see by the public's interest, and so I think it's important that we drill down, and so I apologize for wanting to ask a lot of questions, but I think instead of piling them up and having 85 questions at the end of the day, I think it's important, and I have one question that jumped out at me on this principles for health care. Under number three, it says covers all necessary care, including all coverage currently required by law. And then it says on here medical equipment, supplies, dental care, long-term care. So does that imply that, let's say I'm 75 years old and I need to go in a nursing home and I have the financial ability to pay for that nursing home care, private pay, so that does that mean that I wouldn't have to tap into my asset, that this would cover my stay at the nursing home for 5 or 10 years?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, nursing home care would be covered under this bill, and I think there are very few elderly people who are in nursing homes 5 or 10 years, and it's very, very expensive. And as you know, unless you are very, 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 very wealthy, you could not afford to be a private pay patient for 5 or 10 years. And that's why so many people in our nursing homes are already on public programs, medical assistance. And this would replace that, yes. So it would cover it, and it would be, I mean, the bill, the proposal, the health plan, is very, I mean, it's, healthcare is, what is it, 15%, roughly 14, 13% of our economy. Putting that into this health plan, that's a lot of money. And we'd be replacing through this bill the premiums, copays, deductibles that you and your employer pay. We'd be replacing the taxpayer money you're paying into medical assistance and everything else, and it would be saving you, perhaps, if you are fortunate, you might be not paying for your nursing home care under this, because we'd be treating everybody equally this way. So the answer is yes, you would in that case save the money, but but there aren't many people in the state that could afford 5 or 10 years of nursing home care.
But, Madam Chair, there are people that might have, you know, certainly not have the means to do that, but they might have the ability to pay for a period of time. And I don't know. This is a... I guess I'll just leave it at that. I'm just kind of...
Senator Marty.
This bill is based on ability to pay. The premiums were set based on ability to pay. If you are very fortunate, you'd be paying more. If you're struggling to make ends meet, or if you're one of those million-plus people who can't afford to pay their bills, you'd be paying less. So
What about, Madam Chair, and sorry about that, Senator Marty.
Senator Cornyn.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, what about if I was a snowbird and I was going south for the winter? I'm sure that this plan would negotiate with the providers here in Minnesota. Would this plan then in turn, would we be?
Through the bill.
Residents temporarily.
Okay.
Senator Higgins.
All right.
Senator Higgins and Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty just said what I was going to say, that going, Senator Coring was referencing principle number three, but principle number five says based on the person's ability to pay. So
okay.
I think in long-term care, you would pay down
and other
to a certain
sources.
Point, you know, yeah.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, would this legislation replace Medicare?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, the way this bill is drafted, and again, I will get through all this in the presentation yet, but the way it's drafted is that if the federal government would give us waivers, it would replace it, and we'd be getting the same money from the federal government to pay the Medicare money. That if the federal government would not waive it, that would be the primary payer, and this would be the backup payer. It would
Senator
all
Burton.
Depend on federal waivers.
And Senator Marty, you've handed out this chart from Colorado. I don't know.
I'll be explaining that in a while.
All right. When you do, I have a question
sure.
about it.
Senator Marty.
So, Madam Chair, members, what the bill and what we were trying to do is meet these principles. The plan includes everyone. Everybody pays into it. Now, perhaps some people don't pay into our health care system, and they get benefits out of it. Maybe it's not till they're in the emergency room, but they do get benefits out of it. But everyone would pay into this. Everyone would be covered by it. Young and old, you'd be covered when you are employed, when you're laid off, when you switch jobs. You'd be covered whether you have whether you're healthy or whether you have pre-existing conditions. It covers all medical needs, as I mentioned earlier. People would be able to choose. You'd have a lot more choice under this plan. You could choose your doctor, your clinic, your hospital. And the reason I think that's so, one of the reasons I think that's so critical, not only because you have doctors you trust, but there are a lot of people who have a doctor they've been using for years. They lose their job, they switch jobs, and they're in a new health plan, and you can't go see that doctor. They're not in network. So this would allow people to choose their doctor, their clinic, and hospital. The obvious question, how do you pay for it? The current system is, as we all know, bankrupting many families, many businesses, everybody, school districts, government, everybody is being bankrupted by the system. That's why so many employers have been dropping coverage. The logical assumption in many people's mind would be that won't covering more people for more things cost more money. I'd make the case that this bill will save money. How does it save money? It doesn't save it by denying care. It's prohibited from doing so, but it would save money through administrative efficiency. When you look at administrative costs, I've seen estimates that roughly 30% of our health care dollar, 30 cents of every dollar we spend on health care, goes to administrative costs. That's, as Dr. Setgast mentioned a few minutes ago, that's the cost that the health plan has administratively. It's the cost that the medical provider, the doctor, the clinic, the hospital has, and it's the cost, it's not counting the cost that you and I have. If we spend
the fingers up there. Future health care.
It's kind of cute. Maybe they're trying to
consumers.
Get in here and they couldn't get in the room. But we're spending, when we talk about administrative costs, we don't count the costs you and I have. I mean, just figuring out the if you have pre-tax set aside, as legislators can have, you set aside money for that, collecting all the receipts, sending them all, and think of all the time we spend on those functions. You have most clinics, as Dr. Setgast mentioned, and I think we all know just looking at our own clinics, have multiple billing and accounting clerks because they have to bill many different health plans at different rates with different coverage and different co-pays for the same procedure. And they have to calculate each of those. And then if there's something that's not covered, you sometimes have the doctor taking the time. In her case, she said a half hour to argue that the patient needed more than 4 days of the antibiotic. That's a terrible waste of money, a terrible waste of administrative time. And on top of that, health plans spend much money on marketing, underwriting costs. By having one plan that covers, pays all the bills, all at uniform negotiated rates, you not only save cost for the plan itself, you also save costs for each provider. They don't need 20 billing clerks in a hospital when you have a simple negotiated system for how you're going to set the prices. Additionally, the marketing administrative costs of the multiple health plans go down the tubes, and underwriting costs would be eliminated. Underwriting by insurance companies may make good sense for homeowner insurance. If I have a mansion and you have a little tiny house, I'm going to be paying more. They underwrite us based on the value of things and based on everything else. But underwriting for healthcare doesn't make a lot of sense. Because if you think about the purpose of it, it serves only one purpose, and that is, as you always hear, it's to make healthcare cheaper for younger and healthier people, but that obviously means the converse is also part of the equation, and that is the sicker and older you are, the more you're going to pay for healthcare. And if you think about that, that's backwards. We're saying that the sicker you are, the more you need medical attention, the less chance you're going to have of being able to afford it. And because we'd be no longer having all the reimbursement rates, different reimbursement rates, different deductibles, co-payments, different coverage, I think you'd have very, very significant savings in administrative costs on both sides, both the provider end and the plan end, all of which adds up to real money, plus, to say nothing of the time and effort you spend trying to figure out the bills. I love it when we get in the mail each time you have a service, this is not a bill, and then you get a bill later, and I mean, it's a very messed up system. So reducing administrative costs is one obvious reason, obvious way to save money. The second way is by using healthcare appropriately. People we've all heard use emergency rooms for what should be routine medical care. We heard testimony in Mankato of people who, with 9 pages of dentists in the Mankato phone book, how a medical assistance patient goes 63 miles to Savage to get to see a dentist. I believe in Mankato, they've got one of the better, I think, Mayo cardiac programs in the country. And if you have a heart problem in Mankato, you go to the Mankato Hospital. If you have a heart problem in New Ulm, 30 miles away, different health plan. If it's a serious thing, they'll airlift you to, I think it's Abbott Northwestern in Minneapolis, because it's a different health plan. Think of the wasted money of airlifting people halfway across the state instead of sending them 30 miles away just because it's in a different health plan. The health plan would also save money here by regular access to medical care and visits and urgent care, so you could avoid inappropriate use of emergency care. By reimbursing at a consistent rate, you don't have the problem where people, we heard in heard with the Poverty Commission, people going 2 hours to get to see a dentist who would see them. These are people with dental coverage who medical assistants who can't find a dentist. If you have dentists compensated a fair rate for all their patients, they can't turn away some and force them to travel these long distances for care. And this bill would have a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week nurse phone line to everyone. My health plan happens to do that. It makes a lot of sense. Everybody should have that. Sometimes you can avoid a trip to the doctor just by being able to visit the nurse over the phone. And with that 24-hour urgent care available to people, because urgent care is also cheaper than emergency room when you need to see a doctor after hours. All of these lead up to appropriate use of medical care is a big way of saving money, and it's a big gap in our current system. Then negotiating fair prices. Our current system overcharges for many medical products and services. If you're a member of a health plan, as many people are, you're probably getting better prices through the plan because they're negotiating for you. If you're a private pay person because it's not covered by your health care, if it's not covered by your health care, your private pay, you're going to pay a fortune for it. Because nobody's there negotiating for you. Negotiating fair prices with the drug companies would save large amounts of money. Negotiating prices with providers and for medical equipment. I don't know if a $16,000 wheelchair might cost $8,000 if they had somebody negotiating fairly for you. But we pay a lot more than we should because we don't negotiate fair prices. That's another way you save money. You avoid wasteful excess capacity of costly equipment. The Healthcare Access Commission and every reform effort's been trying to get their hands on this. I think Senator Berglund or Senator Salzman has a bill on radiation care facilities, a moratorium on them. A single plan that sets up a way where you have to get approval to get very expensive equipment is another way of saving money. And then finally, focusing on early intervention and prevention can save a lot of money, too. We don't work to prevent illness up front. We wait until too late. Last year in Minnesota, there were 22,000 emergency room visits for dental care. I'm guessing virtually all of those were cases where somebody had an infection in their tooth, a cavity that wasn't filled, taken care of, the tooth got infected, gets excruciatingly painful, you go see the emergency room. You pay $400 or $500 or whatever. They don't pay it. They don't have the money. We pay it. You pay the $400 or $500. They give you an antibiotic. That's the thing they can do. It takes care of the infection, and they tell you go see your dentist in the morning. You don't have a dentist, so you don't go see your dentist in the morning, and the infection does clear up because you got the antibiotic, and 3-4 months later, the infection flares up again, and you do the same thing over again. 22,000 times a year that happens in Minnesota. Very costly. With mental illness, we could avoid costly hospitalization if we could get, sometimes avoid incarceration by people who are having great trouble and they don't have access to get the mental health care they need when they need it. I think we at the legislature have been very aware of those gaps and we've been working on it. The Healthcare Access Commission at their first hearing had a great presentation by St. Mary's Clinic Duluth program that took people with heart failure, had intensive intervention with nurses, advanced practice nurses, a whole team of care providers, and they had daily contact with the patients. It cut rehospitalization rates by 82%. It cut the overall cost of providing care for these patients by almost half. But why don't we do it? Well, they're actually losing money doing it because we reimburse in a weird way in this system. And under a single health plan, under this health plan, we would be doing it in a way that you take care of the prevention first. Prevention can save big money. And the savings in healthcare are not the only places where you save money. You also save certainly in crime costs and out-of-home placement costs. If you look at chemical dependency, two-thirds of the people in our prisons are there because of offenses they committed under the influence of alcohol or other drugs. California study a few years ago showed every tax dollar spent for chemical dependency saved $7. 700% rate of return to taxpayers by reducing health care costs and crime costs and out-of-home placement costs. So focusing on prevention, early intervention is the fifth way that this legislation would save money.
Senator Marty, you have two senators that really want to ask you a question. Senator Johnson, Senator Berglund. Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I really support this concept. But I think the tricky part is the funding. And way at the beginning of your comments, you said that everyone will pay and everyone will be covered. What about dependent children that don't pay because they don't have jobs? And what about non-working adults that don't have jobs and don't pay? How then does the funding work?
Okay. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, it's, as I said, it's based on ability to pay and dependent children. When I mean everybody pays, it would mean every household would be paying. The premiums would be based on ability to pay, not based on your age, not based on your sickness, your health status. It would be basically every household would be paying. People who are very low income would be paying very little. People who have middle incomes would be paying more. People with higher incomes would be paying more. So it is a system that everybody would be paying something. Every household would be paying something.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Follow up, Senator Marty. You say low income would pay a low amount. There are adults that don't have any income. Would they still be covered?
Senator Marty.
Without paying.
Madam Chair, everybody's covered. If you have zero income, of course, most people need, seniors need money to pay for their rent and their everything else. If you have $0 and you have no housing, no anything, then presumably you wouldn't be paying anything. But it would be based on income, and so if you have any income, you'd be paying something into it.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, you indicated that this system would rectify the problems that we have with our current payment system that would not allow a program like the one you described, St. Mary's in Duluth, to provide better cardiac care to keep people from being hospitalized. How would this bill change the payment system to do that?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, it would be paying for the service there. In that case, the program, what you want to have is the most logical health care you can provide. And in a case like Duluth, where those, I think it was several hospitals got together and do this. They have the whole team, the doctor, the nurse, advanced practice nurse, regular RNs. You'd have a whole team of people working on it the way you know, you're familiar with the program. And you'd be reimbursing them for the phone consultations, if so, for the weight equipment they have for that they had in people's houses and so on. You'd be paying for those services, so they wouldn't be losing money because the services that made the most sense weren't covered, because those services would be covered.
So, Senator Marty, I guess the part that I don't understand is there would still be incentives to hospitalize people, though, because you would be paying more for people to be hospitalized under this program, wouldn't you? And you would still be paying more to a cardiologist than you would to a primary care physician or an advanced practice nurse, wouldn't you?
You would certainly be paying more for hospitalization than the outpatient care. You'd certainly be paying more for the cardiologist than for other professionals who are dealing with the person. That doesn't change. The simple thing is that, you know, most of us are, that program, it's not because, they're not doing it that way because they're benefiting financially from doing it, because they're not. They're doing it because it keeps people healthier, and that's what they want. And it just so happens that it would save us money if we reimburse that way. People are trying to stay out of hospitals. They're trying to stay away from doctors. And if we have a system where it's fairly done, it'll save the money. Just because we're reimbursing for those services doesn't mean all of a sudden people are going to want to drop the program. They'd be more incentive to run the program in an efficient way.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I ask a question because I believe that this is just an example. This program is just an example of the way that our payment system today is failing us. There are many other examples, and so I hope as this goes on that you'll keep working toward trying to figure out how to further reform the payment system. Another example would be if you have an office visit for someone who has diabetes, you get paid for, you know, a 10 or 15 minute office visit, whereas if that person ends up being hospitalized because they go into a diabetic coma, you pay thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars more than that little 10 or 15 minute office visit was worth. And yet if you take longer in the office to prevent that hospitalization, you don't necessarily get paid for it in today's system. So I hope that you'll keep working to try to incorporate more payment reform into your bill.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Berggren, I think we both strongly agree on the need for having payments work in a way that makes sure people get the appropriate care, because our current system is backwards in the way we do it.
Senator Marty and members, by 3, we have to be out of here because the Education Committee needs to come in. So it is, without a doubt, I think that we're going to have to reconvene at 6.
Okay.
And so some of our witnesses will have to come back. And I don't know if they want to, but I think we should try to be diligent about
getting. I will go as quickly as possible. I wanted to explain very quickly that Colorado chart that was handed out, not because that's a measure of what happens here, but just to show the Colorado legislature had a legislative commission like our Healthcare Access Commission. They hired the Lewin Group, a national economics consulting firm, to do an analysis of 4 of their main proposals they were looking at. Colorado starts with, as you can see at the bottom, 792,000 uninsured people. Each of the plans reduced that. One of them cut it about half. That cost $600 million. Other two cut it by three quarters to seven-eighths. But they cost money, too. And the final plan, which would be at least somewhat comparable to this, leaves 0 people uninsured, and that's by its nature. This plan would leave 0 people uninsured and 0 people underinsured, and I think the underinsurance is something we probably hear more from our constituents who have insurance but can't afford the bills. And this one in the Colorado case was estimated to save money. Again, I think we should be looking to get cost estimates, which are very difficult things to do, and maybe funding the cost estimate would be something that we should be looking at for this legislation. With that, I'm going to quickly go through the bill. I've talked a lot about it.
Senator Berggren.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but I did indicate I had a question in regard to this chart, and that is the Colorado Health Payer Health Services program that you reference on the chart had a source of revenue for it. I wondered, since you've included the total healthcare spending column, what would the sources of payment be for that program and how much would they raise?
Okay,
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I told you I'm not that familiar with the Colorado proposal. What I would tell you about this proposal is that ours would replace all of the other payments with simply the premiums paid to the health plan. And I will explain how as I go through the bill quickly. But basically, how the Colorado one was going to pay for it, I don't know. Yes, this is net expenditures on health care, which is what we're ending up all paying in the end anyhow. And again, that's no proof of what this bill would do, because this bill would be presumably significantly different, but ours would be funded by premium paid by employers and employees to the health plan.
And Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I guess the reason I was asking you the question about Colorado is because that would give us an idea of what general ballpark we'd be talking about in terms of those revenues.
Sure.
I also, of course, don't believe that Colorado was paying for long-term care, so it would be a low ballpark in terms of what the Colorado bill was calling for in terms of revenues and expenditures.
But you would, Madam Chair,
Senator
Berglund, on the long-term care issue, but remember there, in terms of the cost, we're paying for the long-term care now, whether it's private pay or medical assistance or whatever.
Right, but most employers are not paying for it.
Right, right.
And so it'd be a new...
Well, most employers are paying through the tax system they're paying for it. We're paying through it through the tax system now. I mean, medical assistance portion of it we are all paying for.
Well, there's a lot of individuals that pay for their own long-term care also. And there is long-term care insurance that's
right.
being purchased by individuals today.
I understand and I agree.
Senator
Madam Chair,
Senator Erickson Ropes.
One quick question related to this chart, Senator Marty. People often wonder about the results based on the group that does this study. And I wonder if you could tell us about the Lewin group. Is that a pro-single-payer liberal group?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, wow. Senator Erickson Ropes. Minnesota has hired the Lewin Group in the past, I believe, and they are owned by United Health Group, which is not particularly, at least as far as I know, is not particularly fond of single payer. But the Lewin Group is, they do a lot of consulting on health stuff. I'm not an expert. Senator Berglund probably knows all these firms better than I do.
Go ahead,
with
Senator
the bill,
Martin.
Madam Chair, members, I'll try and go through it quickly because I've already talked about it. Section 1 simply states the principles. Those are requirements for the health plan in here. Section 2 has the definitions. It has a ethics and conflict of interest provision, just data practices provisions. Article 2, eligibility, you can see in line 3.6. All Minnesota residents are eligible. 3.9, it talks about we'd all have an identification card. We all carry them for our health plans now. We'd all have an identification card. Residents traveling elsewhere would work the same as your current insurance does. Article 3 on benefits. As you can see from this, we cover most things. You can get your services from any licensed provider. Covered benefits include all medically necessary care, obviously things like inpatient, outpatient, medical equipment, rehabilitative care, immunizations, hospice, prescription drugs, mental health, dental care, et cetera. And in subdivision 3, you can see the board may expand benefits to cover treatments as they find new treatments coming on. I think any plan has to deal with those things. What's excluded? The most obviously one is things that have no medical benefit. And then number 2, the second one, cosmetic surgery. We do cover things like Fort Wine stains, breast cancer reconstruction. Those are already covered. Those would be covered. It's just the purely cosmetic surgery would not be. Private rooms in hospitals would not be covered, the extra cost for that. And subdivision 4A on page 6 would require that if you're going to have drugs purchased here, you could not directly market to consumers. Subdivision 5 would prohibit the deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance. Section 2 would be a care coordination thing. I think serving on the Healthcare Access Commission, there was a lot of talk about the importance of care coordination. This would, as you can see there, require all patients to have a primary care provider or some other provider who would coordinate the patient's care. It would not require referrals, but if you saw a specialist and did not have a primary care coordinator, you would have to choose one. Article 4 sets up the fund, the Minnesota Healthcare Fund, that would accept the premiums and other payments. As you can see on the top of page 7, money deposited in the fund shall be used exclusively for purpose of the chapter. This would be a semi, it would not be a state agency, it would be a quasi-state agency perhaps, and it would have its own fund. It would be, the money would go directly to the fund. It would not go through the state treasury. It would not, those premiums would be going directly to the fund. All claims would be made to the healthcare fund by all providers, and payments would be dispersed from the funds. Subdivision 2, we'd be creating 3 accounts, operating capital reserve accounts. If you want more information, you can see those sections. Section 2, revenue sources, the Minnesota Health Plan premium. The board would be setting an equitable, affordable premium structure that would include unearned income as part of the income determination for premiums. It would be progressive based on ability to pay. And there would be an employer premium as well. They would coordinate with existing ongoing sources of funding from federal and state programs, even if we do get federal waivers to fold in medical assistance and Medicare. You would not only need the waivers, you'd need the funding, and that's all provided for later in the bill. Outside, you can raise money from outside sources if you're a nursing home or something. Subdivision 3 is just talking about seeking government waivers and getting funding from federal government for services that federal government previously cared for, reflecting medical inflation and growth of the state budget, growth of state size, growth size and age of the population, et cetera, number of people below the poverty level, et cetera. Subdivision 4 talks about if you can't get federal preemption, then you modify it where those programs would continue to exist, and the health plan would be secondary to the federal government programs for providing that. Subrogation would make it that we'd collect from collateral sources when medical services are provided. Under another policy, like under workers' compensation, the health care portion would be shifted to this. The fund would collect money from the workers' comp insurer. Same thing with automobile, homeowners, the medical components of them. You still have the insurance, except if somebody came to your house, fell down, and so on, and your insurance would cover everything but the medical care, which would be shifted to this, and the insurance plan would be paying into this to cover those costs. Article 5 talks about the payments. It would be all providers licensed in Minnesota can participate in the plan. The plan would negotiate rates and provide with providers and with hospitals. They would not only would have operating budgets, but you have capital budgets. On page 12, large capital purchases over $500,000 would require board approval. How it's governed is Article 6. Section 1 is just exempting them from the Administrative Procedures Act because it's got its own process in place. Section 2 would cap the executive director's salary. I think given the fact we've had so many high administrative salaries in the healthcare system, capping that salary as we cap other state agencies, I think is an appropriate message to send. It's not it's an important message. The plan would be governed, as you can see on page 13, by Minnesota Health Board, which would be composed of 15 members represented from each of 5 rural health planning boards and 3 representatives selected by the Metropolitan Regional Planning Board, which would be the 7-county metro area. So effectively, of the 8 members coming from local boards, 5 would be from greater Minnesota regions and 3 from the metro area. Those 8 members would select a consumer and employer representative and 5 providers. They'd serve 4-year terms. financial duties, the next page it talks about their duties, general duties, financial duties, board will establish and collect the premiums and employer premiums, would approve the statewide and regional budgets, would establish payment rates for providers, and in line 14.33 explicitly points out they can reflect regional differences to address provider shortages. Often when we talk about cost of living in the legislature, we talk about how some of the metro communities need more higher payments because we have a higher cost of living, which I'm never sure is quite the case. We have higher housing costs, but I think in greater Minnesota there are higher transportation and other costs. But the main reason you need regional differences is the fact that in some communities you can't find the providers you need. If you have to pay more to get a provider in a small town where they got to be family practice doctor who's going to be on call every weekend, it's hard to get people there. If you have to pay more to attract somebody there, you would do that. You would pay claims for medical products and services as negotiated. They would negotiate fees and budgets. On page 15, line 11, we start talking about how you ensure cost control by aggressive public health measures, preventive care, promotion of public health, by improving efficiency and care quality in the delivery and administration of our healthcare system, by minimizing administrative costs. As I mentioned earlier, that's no underwriting, no marketing, no hassling over the pre-existing conditions, no hassle over what benefits are covered, and no collection costs for co-payments and so on. All the provisions I talked about for cost control are mentioned there. The board would be responsible for enrollment procedures. It would work with the line 29 through 31 on page 15. It would be working with the federal government on standards to prevent an influx of people for the purpose of obtaining medical care. That would.
Senator Marty, you have a question. Senator Johnson.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Marty, that goes to my question about zero income but eligibility. Line 30 talks about an influx of people, and this is what my concern is. Is there a way to work into your bill maybe a five-year residency or something to beef up the prevention of this?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's a very good question. It's a critically important question, too. I don't think you could use a flat-out five-year residency rule. People who move to Minnesota need medical care. That's why it would require federal government waivers, reimbursement. If there are people, no-income people who have medical conditions who are moving here for medical care, we'd need help with the federal government either to get waivers to address that issue, or we'd have to get reimbursement from them because, frankly, it shouldn't be Minnesota's responsibility for that. And that's a key point. It's one we have to address.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, has any other state successfully implemented this type of program?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, no state has passed something like this to try implementation of it. And, again, issue like this has to be part of it. You can't do a plan like this without provision like that.
Senator Perna-Solomon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Senator Marty and Senator Johnson, there is language in the Children's Health Security Act that limits people moving to Minnesota to secure health care. So there has to be another reason they're coming to the state. It can't be solely for the purpose of obtaining health care.
Senator Hand, Senator Bergling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I'm looking through and trying to this governance structure that you have proposed, and I've got a couple of questions. One is you're establishing the executive office of the Minnesota Health Plan, health board, 15 members with various duties, a health planning regional structure that would anticipate, I think, six different regional health planning boards, an office of health quality and planning, an ombudsman office for patient advocacy, some kind of a structure to deal with grievances, an inspector general. What is the size or the number of people that we would anticipate being employed in this governance structure that do not currently, there are no positions for today? And I notice in the health board structure you have county commissioners being So this would be, in effect, a part-time duty for them to oversee this health plan. Is that correct?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, several questions. With the employees, I would guess that most of them, there are plenty of people in a lot of health plans and so on that, and a lot of people already working for the state who deal with certain parts of planning, but there'd be some transfer. And matter of fact, this plan explicitly allows them to contract out for the billing and bill collection and billing services and so on, administrative functions like that. They could contract out with somebody else to do it. But in terms of the numbers of people, that'd be
a guess, Madam Chair.
Significant, but there are significant numbers, more people employed doing administrative things now than there would be here.
And Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I appreciate that, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot and say how many, what's the number here going to be. But one of the things that has been offered as a criticism of this style of approach is that it would contemplate establishing a large state bureaucracy to administer the plan. And it seems to me, I don't know what the numbers are, but there would be created a, I don't know if large is the right adjective, but a significant state bureaucracy to administer this plan, the leaders of which would be, at least some of them, county commissioners that would then have, in addition to their county commissioner duties, the ability, the requirement to do these other duties. And if you, I look at some of these duties, the financial duties, that they're going to establish the premium rate. They're going to approve the budgets. They're going to establish payment rates for services. And a number of things that are listed in the detail of your bill that are typically decisions that are done in the in private markets and private enterprise through the interaction of supply, demand, sometimes requiring a great deal of expertise and financial analysis and things that businesses have to deal with. And here we have a part-time governance structure that is going to in some way come up with prices and payment rates, and I guess I look at this and I say, what is the incentive that they would have to get this even approximately right, given past history's experience in trying to do this through some governmental body? They always end up doing great harm and sometimes even great damage to people. So how does this structure, if this is going to replace that market decision-making structure, how does this get at efficiencies? There's no incentive for efficiency in this.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, first of all, the board members would be serving terms that would be considered full-time. These would be representatives selected by the regional boards. They would be paid, as you can see at the top of page 14, compensation not to exceed the compensation the Public Utilities Commission members are compensated. Whether that's the right amount or whatever, the point is it is intended to be, they are going to be spending their time working on this. It's not simple. They would be the board. They would not be the ones doing the negotiating. They would be hiring the staff that does this. And as I said, there are many, many people in Minnesota who work in healthcare administration. We're trying to shift them into administering a system that makes sense. You'd still have the same people, very talented people, who work for these companies and others, but that would be providing these functions. But it's a lot of people. You have to remember how big of a sector of our economy the healthcare system is. It's big.
Senator Bergen, excuse me, Senator Hand, do you have
just one last, and this is more of a general question, and I guess as I contemplate this structure of governance that you've proposed and this whole, why wouldn't this, if this idea is sound, which I don't believe it is, but if it is sound, why wouldn't we also seek to create a single-payer food system or a single-payer transportation system or a single-payer life insurance system, whatever it might be? Why wouldn't we try to do that for other things that are arguably just as important to people, like where they live, being able to get around? Why wouldn't we say, let's have a single-payer structure to do that as well?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, that's a good question, and it's a simple answer, too. Yes, food is just as important, but we all have differing tastes in food, different diets. I mean, we have people from many cultures here. Here, food costs are relatively understandable for people. They're bearable. What you might compare this to is police or fire. Your house burns down. You need some urgent service right away. You need it you don't know if you can afford it or not right away. We provide the police. We provide the fire. We all pay into it. We all benefit from it. Here, there's very little ability in many cases. If you're in an auto accident, you can't go shopping to find out if the surgeons are going to be good surgeons. You can't find out what they're charging you. You can't find out whether the hospital is high infection rate, low infection rate. You're going there in an ambulance to get emergency care. And because there are often catastrophic costs here, even lots of middle-income people with insurance and everything still can't afford the bills. So it we don't have, and your point earlier, I don't think everything that's been done in the name of healthcare reform has been necessarily steps forward. But even if you had no intervention anywhere, no state in the country has a free market for prescription drugs. I mean, the whole system relies on secrecy and undisclosed payments, which some of us call kickbacks. I mean, that's the way they manipulate the market. There is no market there for prescription drugs. You don't have people paying five times as much as other people for the same drug, the identical drug. You don't have people paying five times as much for the same drug. That's not volume-based. It's nothing to do with that. There's no competitive market there because there's no good way to do it. So the analogy I'd give is the fact that we all need food. We all need transportation, as you said, so yes. But those work fine in the private market. Or they work relatively well. But our healthcare system doesn't. That's why you have people driving 2 hours to see a dentist when they're dentists in their home community, because our system isn't working. And that's why you need to find a system that puts it together in a logical manner. And the analogy of the shopping for healthcare, I think we'd all like to be able to do that better, but it's when we're shopping under the current system, it's not like you're deciding to buy a vacuum cleaner and you're going to look at Best Buy or you're going to look at Target or you're going to look at Walmart or wherever and decide, can read consumer reports, decide what works. But you can't really do that with healthcare. And if you did, what you're doing is buying a plan, which means you're deciding, I'm going to do all my shopping at Best Buy or all my shopping at Target, all my shopping at Walmart, whether it's good or bad or whatever, I have to go through that system. That's roughly what our comparison would be if you were trying to describe what we have as a market system. And so I think there's a fundamental difference. The market doesn't work here. The market wouldn't be able to work here if we had no government hand in it whatsoever. And there are catastrophic costs, which mean people couldn't afford it no matter what. So that's the reason we need the change.
Senator Berglund and Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, that's inappropriate.
I need to remind the audience that this is kind of reactions not allowed. I'm sorry, but that's kind of the rule. So, Senator Berglund, Senator Higgins, Senator
Madam
Johnson.
Chair, and Senator Marty, do you anticipate that the prices that would be negotiated to pay providers under the system would be at the high level, the medium level, or the low end of the system? There's quite a range of prices that providers are paid now.
Madam Chair, I would say in some cases, in terms of range is hard to say, but in terms of whether they go up or down, there'd be some going up, there'd be a lot going down perhaps.
So you'd be thinking more like average.
Yeah, I suppose you might call it average. They'd be negotiating for each. I mean, if there's a specialty that's very, very high reimbursement rates, it might not be as high. Other specialties, psychiatry, they may be paying more. In other words, it depends on the situation. The same way a health plan attempts to negotiate now, and the bigger health plans have more negotiating clout than the smaller ones, a plan that covers everyone has some negotiating clout.
Well, they'd be setting the prices, and I'm just trying to understand whether you could have something that cost a lot more here if every provider was going to be insisting on being paid at the high end of what providers get paid in each specialty.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, if I'm understanding your comments correctly, and maybe I'm not, but I wouldn't agree with either of the two comments if I heard them right, one of which was that the plan would be setting the price instead of negotiating it, because I don't think they could do that. I mean, if they're just going to set a price and it's going to be arbitrarily, they're not going to set a price arbitrarily too high. If they set one arbitrarily too low, providers aren't going to, I mean, you'd have providers moving if that was the case. So they can't, it is a negotiated rate. And on the other hand, the providers don't have all the say either. They can't just say, hey, I want to be paid more. It's a negotiated issue. I mean, providers negotiate with health plans now. They'd be negotiating with this. No side is going to have total control over it. It's negotiated.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, would there be any direction given to this board that they would be required to negotiate a cost that would not be higher than the cost we pay presently?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, the board is, like all of us, has the incentive to negotiate as inexpensive of a contracts as they can. And again, but you can't guarantee they would never be able to pay more, because I think, as I mentioned, in some rural communities where you can't get general practitioners, you'd have to pay more.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, when I talk about more, I'm talking about collectively more.
Collectively.
I'm talking about the total cost to be negotiated at a higher level. I'm not talking about one provider getting paid more than they are today or another getting paid less than they are today. But you could have pressures to raise everything to the highest amount that anybody is getting paid. And I mean, I don't see exactly how that might not happen. The other concern that I have, Senator Marty, is even if you did get a fee schedule negotiated, then how would you control for utilization? So if I'm a provider and my fee all of a sudden isn't as much as it had been previously, then I just do more things and I'm getting paid more all of a sudden because I'm getting paid for each thing I do.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, again, I want to stress that in terms of this, the health plan has some significant power in negotiations, but again, it is negotiated and that's the nature of it. Neither side holds all the cards. In terms of utilization, there are a handful of people in this state, maybe more than a handful, but it's relatively smaller problem than underutilization. Most of us, in terms of us, not the doctor's side of things, but the patient side of things, most of us try and stay away from doctors. And you don't have people rushing out and saying, you know, I got the afternoon off, why don't I get a colonoscopy? I mean, we hate going to the doctor. I mean, most of us do. I know there are some people who don't. And in terms of the provider, because that's the other part of it, yes, you could have providers who try and abuse it. We have providers who abuse the current systems. First of all, you have a much simpler system, so it's easier to find out about abuse. And second of all, most doctors do try and do the right thing. I know there's some who probably do it. The other thing you have to do is you set up a system so you don't have conflict of interest, where I'm going to refer you to a clinic where I have an investment in the clinic for radiology services and so on. I think the kind of thing that you've been working on is exactly what we have to do with that kind of overutilization.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, just one comment, and then maybe this will be an area that you could keep working on as well. The Wenberg studies show that there is a range of between 20 and 50% differences in the amount of services given to people in our medical care system, and that it doesn't make any difference in terms of outcomes. Those doing the 20% level of services are having outcomes very similar to those doing the 50% level. So it isn't a matter of providers necessarily trying to rip off the system, and it isn't necessarily patients trying to see a doctor more often than they need to. It is something that's inherent in our system. And I am just suggesting that maybe that needs to be something that would be addressed in your bill as well, so we don't get more deviation or greater utilization that's not achieving a desired outcome.
Senator Marty, Senator Higgins has a question. We have about 55 minutes, and we have heard only from one of your witnesses. So I would like to encourage you to move, because you're going to have to call people at 6. So they are going to have to stay here. But Senator Higgins has a question, and then Senator Fishback has a question. And
Madam
then you
Chair,
should
I'll pass, okay. Given the timing.
And mine will be short, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, on page 8, you say that we the money held in reserve by city, state, and local county health programs will be transferred to the Minnesota Health Fund. Is there any way we can get some seed money from the reserves of the existing health plans? I understand they have more money in reserve than they've ever had before. The second is under the subrogation on the next page, where you include workers' comp in there. Mm-hmm. If there is ever a system that needs to be included in a single-payer plan and eliminated from our entire being, it is the workers' comp system. This would be a very logical thing to put into a single-payer universal health coverage, get rid of those insurance premiums that everybody pays in workers' comp. We would no longer have the delay and deny syndrome that we have in workers' comp, and I think all around the workers would be much healthier, and the companies would love to get rid of the premiums, and it could fold seamlessly into this.
Senator Marty.
I strongly agree, and on the first point you made, I think, yes, it is appropriate that reserves currently held, those were paid by their patients. They would be, it's the patient's money. Should be included with it. I will continue very quickly. I won't go through as much detail. We would, the health board management duties at the bottom of page 15, they would set up the enrollment procedures. They'd work with the federal government. I talked about that one. That's where I guess I left off. They would establish an electronic claims and payment system, much easier than under our current system. To do that, they'd monitor at top of page 16 through consumer surveys and regular data collection, evaluation, adequacy and quality of services, need for changes in benefits, cost of each type of services, and effectiveness of cost control measures under the program. Looking down there, number 7 on line 9, they would collaborate with public health agencies, schools, and community clinics. I think we all recognize the importance of this. That's one of the things the board would be mandated to deal with. The board, subdivision 7, their policy duties, implement cost control, quality assurance procedures, including professional peer review, ensure strong public health services, which many of our community public health services are underfunded, and that's one of the best ways to save medical costs, ensure culturally and linguistically competent care on line 26. Then the regional planning boards, these local boards, there would be one in the 7 county metro area, 5 rural ones. They would consist of at least initially one county commissioner per county in greater Minnesota and 2 county commissioners per county in the metro area. Line 13 on page 17, you see the board duties, recommend priorities and guidelines for the region, prepare budgets, to recommend, collaborate with local public health agencies. And again, line 22 and 23, I point out earlier, there'd be 24-hour nurse hotline and 24-hour urgent care clinics available to everyone. Office of Health Planning and Quality, it's much needed. In the current system, nobody, no one entity is in charge of this. We could do a much better job in promoting overall public health and wellness and efficiency if we have an Office of Health Quality and Planning. The next page just goes over a number of the things I won't go into now because of time. Create on line 28, section 7, ombudsman's office would be totally independent from the health plan, would be appointed by the governor, would be removable only for just cause. Their budget would be set by the legislature totally independently from the health board, and they would be to ensure patient advocacy services are available. There's a grievance process. They'd evaluate, respond to consumer complaints, and receive recommendations about how to improve it. But they would have total freedom from the health plan. They would have a grievance system under Section 8 that they would set up. And under that system, page 20, line 8, the patient would have a right, within 30 days, if possible, to get the results of the ombudsman's investigation and the disposition. If an ombudsman offered an order of corrective action on the health plan, it would be binding, appealable only in district court. There would be an inspector general's office to investigate, audit, and review the records, et cetera, investigate fraud and abuse, et cetera. And the legislative auditor on page 21 would also have examination authority over it, too. The section, Article 7, the implementation, we'd be, and that's just details in terms of effective date, we'd be repealing major parts of our law. And I want to point out one final thing. You'll notice this is a 22-page bill that covers everything, and I think what's a simple, direct, and understandable, sensible means. The 1993 Clinton health proposal was 1,300 pages, I think, remember seeing pictures of it. They couldn't explain it to themselves or to anybody else. I think there is some merit. You shouldn't have simplicity just for regardless of whatever else, but simplicity is a plus if people can understand what they're getting and how they're dealing with it. And again, finally, I would just close by saying that I think healthcare should be treated as a right, as a community need, something we all need, just like police and fire protection. And when it's treated the way we do now as a commodity, something you buy or sell, you buy it when you can afford it. And if you can't afford, you buy as much as you can afford if you can't afford enough. And that does not serve us well. And in the end, the taxpayers pay for those who don't get the coverage. So that's my presentation, and I do have several witnesses. I can take questions now again, though people have been asking along the way, or witnesses, your choice.
Questions from the members. Please go ahead
I'll
and call your witness.
Mary Cowan first. Mary here.
Mary Cowan.
Oh. And I'll have Leah Erickson next.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
My name is Mary Cowan.
Could you tell us who you are and what you do?
I have been a nursing assistant at Children's Hospital Minneapolis for 13 years.
Thank you.
I am a member leader of SEIU Minnesota Healthcare of Minnesota. I care for my patients and do the best that I can with the resources provided. In January, the cost of my health insurance went up about $250 per month. The increase came on top of the $551 per month I was already paying. That would have meant working almost 2 weeks every month just to pay for my health care for my family. I could not afford that. So I had to opt for a cheaper policy with a 20% copay. Of course, my husband then got sick with kidney stones, and the bills are now starting to pile up. And I have asthma, but now I often defer treatment to save money. And then last week, I got so bad I had to go to the emergency room, and I am still awaiting for that bill. I am not here to ask for your pity or to beg for a handout. I'm here to tell you that this system is broken and we can do better. What I want is fair value for my money. I expect every dollar spent on health care to buy a dollar worth of care. I don't want to pay insurance companies to figure out how not to provide care. Other people like Senator Marty can show you the statistics on how we pay too much for health care. To me, those statistics mean every year thousands of dollars are stolen from me. That is money I cannot spend on my family, or more importantly, time I cannot spend with my family. Working in health care every day, I see how the private insurance systems waste the time, money, and resources on healthcare workers. I deal with patients while doctors spend hours on the phone talking with insurance companies. If people all over the world can provide all of their citizens with health care of equal or better quality for far less money, then why can't we? Just like any other health policy that comes to the legislature, SEIU members like me are going to ask a few key questions. Will every Minnesotan have access to care? Will every Minnesotan be able to afford health care? Will it improve the health of our community? In the case of the Marty bill, the answer is yes.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Any questions from the members? Questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Leah Erickson.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Erickson, if you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Leah Erickson. I'm a single mother of a 14-year-old boy. I work full-time, own my own home in Robbinsdale, and I'm fortunate enough to have a very supportive family in the area. I was diagnosed with lupus at the age of 13, and because of that, I developed kidney failure in my mid-20s. In order to keep my health coverage, I have to work full-time. On top of my 40-hour week, I spend a minimum of 15 hours in dialysis. Dialysis is a very exhausting and draining process, which makes it impossible for me to keep up with my chores at home, and it takes time away from my son. My son has had to essentially take over all of the household chores, which is an unfair burden for a 14-year-old. I could go on disability, but I had the experience of being on disability for a short time due to a previous illness, and I hated it. I want to be a productive member of society, I enjoy my job, and I don't want to stop working. In addition to physical and emotional burden of dialysis, I have a large financial burden. Adding up my $2,200 deductible, which I always meet by March, plus my son's deductible, the copays for office visits, and my premiums, the minimum expenditure I face per year is over $8,000. I'm always struggling to keep up with my medical bills. I've gotten behind at times, and my credit has suffered. Under the Minnesota Health Plan, I could choose to work fewer hours per week and fit dialysis into my work day, which would allow me to spend more time with my son and contribute to my own household and enable me to get out of debt. Thank you for your time and your support of this very important piece of legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Any questions from the members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, I'd like to call Susan Jordan.
Ms. Jordan, welcome. If you could please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you very much. My name is Susan Jordan. I work for the Housing Authority in Duluth, Minnesota. I am here representing the Citizens Federation as well as a cadre of activists for healthcare in the Northeast. I'm here to tell my story and to let you know why we need universal healthcare, not only in Minnesota but across the United States. My life is the perfect example of how you can do everything right and still lose everything due to inadequate insurance coverage. In October of 1993, our oldest child was diagnosed with a seizure disorder and loss of central vision in her right eye. 2 weeks later, my husband suffered the first of many episodes of congenital heart failure. After 3 weeks in the hospital, 9 of those days in intensive care, he was diagnosed with an extremely rare heart condition. We were told that it is incurable and ultimately fatal. It's also a dominant genetic trait, so both of my children have it too. I was laid off shortly after my husband was diagnosed, and we found ourselves living on welfare, someplace we never thought we'd be. We decided that it was too expensive to live in the city, so we moved to Duluth. I began working at the Housing Authority and became eligible for their insurance in 1996, the first year that we started to have insurance go up 17% a year. My income went up an average of 1.1% a year. My husband was self-employed, so I carried the medical insurance for our family. Over the next 10 years or so, my husband suffered congestive heart failure a few times a year. He would be hospitalized each time, which meant a loss of income and increased expenses each time. We both knew that working was accelerating his disease, but he insisted on continuing to work as much as possible. We believed that it was important to do whatever we could to take care of ourselves. I worked two or three jobs at a time so that we could stay afloat during those times when he was unable to work. But we were always one crisis away from disaster. That crisis came crashing down on us in June of 2004. My husband had two strokes that day. He completely lost the ability to recognize words or names or do complex reasoning. On his second day in the hospital, the doctors told us that once we were home, he would not be able to be left home alone at all. They also told me that they'd be letting him go the next day. I was absolutely frantic about how I would care for him on my own. I asked the doctors if it was possible to move him to the rehab center for a week so I could prepare my house and make it safe. They stated that they would prefer to do that, but the insurance would not cover it because my husband was capable of using the bathroom on his own and feeding himself. I just couldn't believe that the doctors thought it was necessary for him to stay, but the insurance company had the power to veto that decision. I sought out assistance from the medical social worker on the neurology floor. We called the insurance company together and explained my situation, namely that I must go to work. Remember that I am the one who carries the insurance. If I don't work, there's no insurance. I asked for nursing assistance as my 13 and 14-year-old daughters were the only ones at home to care for my husband. The woman from the insurance company stated, and I quote, "Well, I guess they are just going to have to step up to the plate, aren't they?" It still makes me cringe when I think about it. The insurance company did not allow my husband to go to rehab 4 days a week. I'm sorry, they did allow him to do that. However, because we are less than 5 miles away from the rehab center, they would not pay for him to stay there during the day, and they would not pay for transportation to get him there or bring him back home. What that meant, that he could either not go at all, or I would need to use all of my health and vacation time, as well as every break and every lunch, to transport him back and forth, which I did, of course. 4 months later, he was sent to Mayo Clinic for open heart surgery. This meant more loss of income and more expenses, not covered by insurance. My husband's prescription copays were now almost $600 per month, and we were still lacking one income. While we were considered low income, we made $17 a month too much to be eligible for any kind of public assistance. This is when financial ruin finally found us. I simply had to choose between his medications and the mortgage or car payments. I received the mortgage foreclosure papers and the vehicle repossession papers on the same day. I'll never forget it. I was so angry that we had worked so hard for so long to get the little bit that we had. And now it was all going to be gone because we were unlucky enough to have a medical problem. This is my friend Tony. This year, our medical insurance costs have gone through the roof. Hard to believe it could have gotten worse. Duluth is suffering a financial crisis due to unfunded retiree health care liability. All city employees and subgroups were forced to go to one plan. Our cost for insurance increased over $2,000 a year. My paycheck has decreased every year for the past 4 years due to health care increases. We were also forced into a new prescription plan. This plan separates drugs into three tiers. What the insurance company reps will tell you is that you can now get many prescriptions for no copay at all. This first tier is where the generic drugs are, and this is the insurance company's way of enticing you to use generic drugs. The second tier has a $15 copay. We were told that insulin is on the second tier to encourage diabetics to take better care of themselves. As a diabetic, I'm happy to have this incentive, as I just don't know if I could take care of myself if my insulin was free. What the insurance representatives don't tell you is that the most expensive medications will only be covered 70%, even if there is no generic alternative. Five of the medicines my family needs are on this tier. If we took them, it would meet an added cost of over $1,100 a month. A month. We don't take them. I'm a case manager in community supportive services. Ironic. So I spend every day helping others overcome barriers to self-sufficiency. I'm on the Harbor City School Board and the board of directors of our local social justice organization, East Hillside Patch. My husband and I did everything that we were supposed to do to be contributing members of society. We relocated to a more affordable area. We worked several jobs at a time. We purchased a very small home. We didn't spend extravagantly, and we'd never been on a vacation. We raised our children to care for others and to work hard. None of it mattered when it came to the reality of long-term medical problems. I live in fear of the day that I get the call that my husband has had another stroke. Now that our children are in college, I simply do not know how I would care for him. If we continue with the current system, my children will be forced to live in poverty if they want to have health care. The pool system of determining rates means that prices will continue to rise as the population continues to age. For-profit healthcare has taken control of our economy, and we must work to find a better way before the whole country is bankrupt. Adequate healthcare is not a privilege for the wealthy. It's a basic human right. This is a universal problem, and it requires universal change. Thank you for letting me tell my story.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jordan.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. So we begin to really understand what is that we really need to do and how important it is that we act. Any questions from members? Thank you again. Senator Marty, who's next?
Dr. Maury Hodges.
Dr. Hodges, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the privilege and honor of speaking. My name is Dr. Morrison Hodges. I was chief of cardiology at the Hennepin County Medical Center, or HCMC, from 1974 until 1995 when I retired, from 74 to 95. As you probably know, HCMC is a full-service hospital in Minneapolis across from the Metrodome. It's often referred to as a charity hospital, meaning that it exists to provide health care to people who don't have the financial means to get health care elsewhere. When I started work at HCMC 34 years ago, there were numerous charity hospitals in the United States, but now there's only a handful in the entire country. And of those remaining, I think HCM is certainly the best and provides the best care. The billing situation when I arrived in 1974 at Hennepin County was very unusual. There was in place a long-standing agreement with the federal government by which Medicare and Medicaid was billed a fixed daily amount for each qualifying patient, regardless of what the diagnosis was. So if a person came in for one day for a minor problem, they billed the government for the same amount as if they were in there for a month for heart surgery. And it also included physicians' fees. And the federal government, as you might guess, tolerated this because actually they were paying a lot. They realized they were paying less than they would otherwise. And in general, if a patient didn't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid, or they didn't have some other means of payments, insurance payment, then the bill was usually written off. And this situation worked fine for patients, but the hospital continually operated at large losses. So in 1982, they decided to switch to a system whereby the hospital billed for services provided and physicians billed on a fee-for-service basis. I chaired the committee that implemented this system, and it started in 1984, and it's still in place today. Under this system, every patient's billed for all services by the hospital and physicians. Medicare and Medicaid patients and patients with their own insurance usually get by and got by okay. But uninsured patients often had a very difficult time, and many of them ended up losing all their savings and sometimes even their car or their home or other property. I have to confess that prior to 1982-84, I'd not thought much one way or the other about our health care system. I thought a lot about health care, but not necessarily the system. But when some of my patients began asking me if I could help them avoid financial ruin or bankruptcy, I realized that the new system had made things much worse for many patients. And I started asking myself what was going on. I asked, why does our society give library privileges to these same destitute patients, schooling for their children, or use of highways for them and their families, fire, police, protection, all without direct costs from them, no fees for reading books, there was no tuition for schools, there was no charges for highway use, but you had to pay for everything you got in terms of health care, one way or the other. I began to realize that health care should be a right for all Americans, just as it is a right for citizens of all other developed countries in the world, all others. We were treating our patients at HCMC, though, and all patients in America were being and are being treated as if health care were a privilege, not a right. We've heard those words before today. Over the past 20 years, I've studied our health care system, and I believe that in 2008, I believe that this year we could pay for everything we do, medical care, dental care, nursing home care, long-term care, mental health care, pharmaceuticals, for all Americans, with the $2.1 trillion that we will spend this year for health care. But I don't think we could do it with for-profit health insurance. The fact is that the free market doesn't work for health insurance. And if I could quote Paul Krugman, a New York Times columnist, a rigid belief that markets are always superior to government programs stands in the way of rational thinking about what should replace the present health care system, unquote. I think health insurance is not like high-definition TV sets. Competition for high-definition TV sets leads to lower prices and better TV sets. Competition with for-profit health insurance leads to higher prices and restricted care, as we just heard. It's simply not possible to show that patients benefit when billions of dollars of money the public thinks should go to their health care goes instead to shareholders and offices of public corporations. A single-payer system with government as a collector and payer of monies is the only answer, in my opinion. And this is the reason that I strongly endorse and support the Minnesota Health Plan and the Minnesota Health Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hodges. Any questions? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Doctor. Couple of questions, if I might. Just to clear up something that I've heard, I don't know if you know this answer, but I keep hearing, like in oral health care, that at HCMC that there's anywhere up to 25 or 28% of the emergency room visits are dental care issues. Is that do you have any idea if that's the case? Or
Dr. I have an idea, but I don't have exact numbers. It's been 12 years since I worked at Hennepin. But I think that's probably not far off. I know the dental physicians at Hennepin were very, very busy in the emergency department when I was there.
So you do have, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, that you do have dental physicians that are on staff there?
Yes, we did. We had very active dental department.
Okay. And if I may, that's not the appropriate place for them to get this care, though. I'm assuming they should be getting that at a dentist in a regular setting than at the emergency room, and that obviously it costs a lot more for those folks to go there. And in terms of the cost of going to a single payer, what you're arguing for, does it make more sense to go to more of a preventive care, or are you, in terms of where we would save this money? I know we talk a lot about administrative waste, but I think what I'm hearing is a lot of the delivery of care there's a lot of waste that goes on simply because we're misapplying where that care should be. Has that been your experience?
Yes, definitely. I think
Dr.
Emergency department is used, as we all know, by many, many people as the place to go if they get sick. And they don't go anywhere for prevention. They may not get a flu shot, but they go to the emergency room as soon as they feel they may have the flu. And they might not have the flu if they gotten the flu shot.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson Rose.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Hodges, appreciate your testimony. I have a question about the hospital end of things. You're talking about charity care and unpaid bills and some of the things. Not only HCMC, but every hospital in the state has accounts receivable and a certain number of probably thousands of dollars that they write off and bad checks. What would happen to all those unpaid costs and unpaid bills in a single payer system for the hospitals?
Well, Dr. Hodges.
I was a caregiver, not an administrator of the hospital, but, and perhaps Senator Marty could better answer this, but I would think that under a single payer system that we're talking about in the Minnesota Health Act, all hospitals would be equal in a sense. Hennepin would not then be a health charity hospital, but a health care hospital. And I can tell you, if you look at U.S. News and World Report, it's the only quote-unquote charity hospital that is recommended in a number of areas as being in the top 50 in the United States. And it's a quality hospital. And I think if there was a level playing field, Hennepin could compete very well with other hospitals in the Twin Cities for patients based on quality. And I don't know what might be in the cards for reporting quality under the Minnesota Health Act. Perhaps Senator Marty covered that and I was not paying attention, but I would expect there'd be something that would tell you which hospitals have good results and which don't, and which doctors do pretty well and don't, which doctors practice preventive medicine and which don't. And you could look around and use the market in that sense to find what you want.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one
Senator
quick
Marty.
Comment on that, and that is that, first of all, there wouldn't be a problem of uncompensated care because the plan would cover everyone. So you wouldn't have those inequities. Hennepin and regions and lots of others are having strict problems with that. I think that we take care of the problem that way, and I think it's critically important that we do. And, Madam Chair, as soon as we're done with this witness, I have one more, but there's also Ms. Bruner from the health plans cannot be here this evening, and I would like, she said her testimony was fairly brief, and I'd like to be able to get her before we.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Marty. Thank you, Dr. Hodges. Really appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
So I would like to call Julie Bruner from the Council on Health Plans. Again, I have one more witness
Ms. Bruner,
of my own later.
Thank you. Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Ms. Bruner. Please proceed with your testimony if you could introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, and members of the committee, my name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Council of Health Plans is the trade association for the 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota that provide coverage to over 4 million people. The Council supports the goal of universal coverage for all Minnesotans, and I think the testimony today, you've heard some really compelling reasons why universal coverage is important. We believe in access to high-quality care through public or private coverage. We also share the frustration over rising health care costs and rising premiums, making coverage unaffordable for more and more people. Minnesota's health care system does some things very well. Innovations to improve quality, coverage that covers a wide range of benefits, and efficient administrative systems. Healthcare leaders from countries such as Germany, Holland, France have visited Minnesota in the last year to learn about ways we do things here, how to improve their systems. Through these visits, we learned that no country has a perfect system. Every healthcare system is struggling to balance the needs of citizens with the economic realities of health care's rising costs. Places such as Canada still do not cover prescription drugs taken outside the hospital. Some countries do not provide treatment to individuals over a certain age. But in every case, governments are challenged to keep up with rising health care costs. There are other examples of trade-offs faced by healthcare systems throughout the world. While the United States falls behind many countries in providing basic coverage to all citizens, our advances in technology and medical miracles are the envy of the world. Through these visits, we also learn details on what these other countries do really well. They provide coverage to all citizens, and they make a strong commitment to public health policy. Coverage for all is absolutely necessary. There are many proposals that will help us reach this goal in Minnesota. At 7.2% uninsurance rate, we have the lowest uninsurance rate in the country. Throwing out the entire current system, the good and the bad, isn't the quickest or most efficient way to reach the remaining uninsured. As you probably know, 60% of the uninsured already qualify for existing public health care programs. We believe we must continue our efforts to help these individuals enroll. On public health, other countries are light years ahead of Minnesota and the United States in a commitment to public health. To help slow rising costs long term and make a true commitment to the health of Minnesotans, public health must be a priority. This work includes reversing rising obesity rates, especially among children. It also includes continued efforts to help smokers quit, lowering the prevalence of binge drinking and other drug abuse. Through our discussions with the healthcare leaders from other countries, we did find a common theme: rising costs. The cost of care is making it nearly impossible to sustain any system. We don't see where Senate File 2324 truly addresses the rising costs of health care. Health care is not expensive because of insurance. Insurance is expensive because of the rising costs of health care. It's too easy to claim that eliminating health plans solves the cost problem. The work of the plans must still be done, and that's been pointed out in the discussion today, even by the author. Even in systems that are completely funded by taxes, these functions, these administrative functions, still have to continue. Countries with completely tax-funded systems are turning to the private market for advice on how to address their needs. In France, for example, 86% of the citizens carry private coverage to bridge the gap between what is covered by the government system and what individuals need. Rising costs must be addressed in order to sustain any system. We must address this problem. But understand that systems with health plans and systems without health plans are all dealing with the same challenge: the rising costs of health care. We agree health care reform is needed in this country. We agree that universal coverage is necessary. However, a single-payer system in Minnesota is not the answer. Although our system is imperfect, Minnesota has one of the best health care systems in the country. It's world class. We have made great strides to improve quality and have lower costs than comparable states. Still, we know we can do more. We remain committed to working with the legislature and the administration to try to make this a reality. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Prentisol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bruner, don't you think that administrative costs could be cut significantly, though, if there were a single payer and there weren't numerous paper forms and prior authorization forms and all the staff that are required to wade through all of that material?
Madam Chair and Senator Solon.
Ms. Bruner.
Minnesota probably has some of the health plans in Minnesota have some of the lowest administrative costs in the country. And I think tomorrow in Senator Berglund's committee, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, will be giving a report on health care, managed care, his overview of managed care. We have very low administrative costs in the nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. We're lower than other states around the country. There are always going to be administrative costs in health care. I mean, we're not going to get around them.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Bruner.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bruner Solon.
Do you care to respond to the high costs of CEOs, that the high profits that are obtained?
Ms. Bruner.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, you're talking about the CEO salaries?
Yes.
Do I want to reply? Not particularly. Will I reply? Absolutely. The CEOs that operate the health plans in Minnesota operate billion-dollar businesses. These are highly talented, very responsible individuals who run huge, huge corporations. The plans have, these plans' CEO salaries are far less than what you will find out in the for-profit world of healthcare. And I would venture to say, and sometime I'll try to figure this out, I would venture to say that if you took every CEO salary from a nonprofit health plan in Minnesota and probably the top 10 paid individuals in each one of these plans and you added them together, you wouldn't move the dial on the cost of health care in Minnesota. CEO salaries are not driving health care costs in Minnesota. The utilization and costs of health care are pushing this system forward. That's where we need to attend to in health care reform.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Bruner. This might be a silly question, but from the health plan's point of view, is universal care, does that mean 100% of the people are covered?
Ms. Bruner.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, we believe that universal coverage means everyone has access to health care.
Okay. And one
follow-up
question.
Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. You mentioned that utilization is one of the driving factors. Are you saying that people are using the current system too much, and that's why we're experiencing too high of the costs going up?
Ms. Bruner.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, there are a variety of reasons why health care costs are increasing. Technology is a gigantic driver of health care. In some areas, utilization is a huge driver of health care. The plans have made efforts to, for instance, monitor and hold down or oversee the use of high-tech imaging, much to the consternation of the provider community. There isn't a single sort of a laser that you can come in on with respect to what's driving it. There are a variety of components that are really advancing health care costs.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment on Senator Pretner Solon's question, and that is just to remind the members that last session we did pass uniform billing. And so that means that every single provider will be sending in one form to get paid. And all of the insurance companies and health plans, and if they don't get out from under it this year, workers' comp, et cetera, will be using the same billing form, and so there won't be thousands of different kinds of billing forms.
Electronically.
Yes, thank electronically you. Done.
Senator Higgins and Senator Erickson-Ropes. No, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bruner. I just tend to... Sometimes when I'm looking at different systems of bills that come across, I look at who benefits. And In my opinion, it seems that in a single-payer system, we sidestep the insurance industry. Instead of paying for every dollar in healthcare premiums going through the insurance company, which is sort of a medical middleman that's gotten itself between the patient and the doctor, instead of giving every dollar to the insurance company and having them take some of that money and then put a greatly reduced number of cents into the actual delivery, if we bypass the insurance middleman, the people that are going to benefit are the people. Could you respond?
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson-Robes, you're setting up, you're going to have to set up another insurance function if you eliminate the health plans. All of the work will need to continue. You'll still have to have that function done elsewhere. So instead of the 33,000 employees of the 16,000 employees of the 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota, you'll have X thousand, I don't know, I wouldn't venture to guess what it would be, operating a state level insurance company. The work still has to be done.
Senator Marty, you need to make
Madam
a decision
Chair,
as to how we
now
proceed.
A recess until what time? 6:30.
Six o'clock.
In the same room here. We cannot leave stuff here because there's
Madam Chair
coming in the meantime. But
thank you. Senator Fishback has a question.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, just kind of a question. Ms. Bruner, you can go. It's about I shouldn't excuse you. I shouldn't. But I was just asking about this evening. How late do we plan on going this evening, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Fishbach, I think I only have one more witness, and there are two more opposing witnesses, and then whatever discussion. So I don't think that'll take too long. We also have Senator Kubui's bill on medical technology licensing. And I don't know. There will be presentations on both sides of that, but I'm hoping not too late. I'm hoping, like, maybe 8. I don't want to guarantee that, though, because I don't know how long we're going to spend on that bill.
Thank you, members. So we will be in recess until 6 p.m.
No, I understand that.
I just wanted some idea, because I have to be going.
Yes, no problem.
All right, we'll try and get you.